All right, this is the March 23rd statutory interpretation class, the one immediately after spring break. So we will incorporate a lag time for answers, questions, and dialogue. Hopefully everyone is sort of getting back into the groove of things. I know this is your very first class back, I hope. No one has an earlier class, right? Okay, so with that, remember, I know this is a long time ago, way back to before spring break in our last class. What we're focused on now are the use of extrinsic materials to interpret statutes, things outside the text of the statute itself. And we start with some of the basic backdrop principles that are common to almost any statutory interpretation approach. One, common law. What role does common law play as the warp and woof behind the backdrop of every statute's text? Now remember, the common law principle was statutes would be that derogate common law would be construed strictly. The idea being that they would preserve the integrity of the seamless web of common law. That principle has become eroded significantly by the passage of time. And we discussed how statutes can incorporate common law terms expressly and take advantage of that history of common law. But at the same time, common law does not have that trump hand in interpretation. The case we talked about specifically, remember, was the Smith versus Wade case. The case in Missouri, where the prison officials were being sued by a prisoner who had been assaulted by their cellmates. The question was, did they enjoy sovereign immunity? And what happened was we went through the discussion about how common law applied historically in the situation of providing sovereign immunity to prison officials. And we had a debate taking place between Brennan and Rehnquist as to what was the intent behind the congressional statute passing the language, and the exchanges of long and obscure citations of cases as to what the common law was at the time of the statute, which was passed back after the Civil War. Remember, Justice O'Connor had that beautiful, pithy encapsulation of the debate, where she accused the other two justices of exchanging musty case law and footnotes back and forth. The point there is that there's a reason. Justices and judges, federal and state, will look to what the common law backdrop was, particularly with legal terms, because the understanding is that legislators knew what those meanings were when they wrote the statute. Now, as always, there's the open-ended question. And this is the one you might want to think about. Could Congress or a state legislature basically punt and say, this statute's term, whatever it should be, will be defined according to common law now and in the future? Can you have open-ended terms that Congress meant to evolve as the common law evolved? As odd as that sounds, we have statutes that are like that. The Sherman Act, the antitrust context, for example. But what I pose for you is, while that concept gets floated about occasionally and has been endorsed by some courts, does that pose constitutional questions? Is it possible that a statute that is unconstitutionally vague because it incorporates by reference common law terms that tend to skitter as time goes by? This is a question that has different answers depending where you're at. For example, in Texas, there's a Supreme Court case that expressly says the Texas Constitution prohibits the incorporation by reference of terms of common law or other statutes that change into the future. All you can do is incorporate by reference and freeze it in time. So this idea of a flexible evolving term is prohibited under Texas law. So that was common law. The other thing we talked about, we started to talk about until time ran out, was historical context. Not only just what the history was in the common law case books behind the statute, but what was happening in the newspapers? What was happening in the actual living, breathing history taking place when Congress was passing a statute? To what extent can a judge look outside this text of the statute and look at the milieu, the activity of life around it, and figure out what those terms meanings were based on the historical context surrounding them? How far can you go? In that respect, we got to our last case of last March 11th, so the 12 days ago, which was the Leo case. If I remember right, Leo Sheep versus United States, 1979. And this is a case that beautifully demonstrates the role of history not necessarily legal principles, but just straight up history can play in interpreting a statute. So with that, I'm going to do the terribly unfair thing and ask you to think back 12 days now, before vacation. And if you could sort of give us a quick sense, what was the Leo Sheep case, which I'd say is probably the most unappealing name of any case we'll have this semester, but the Leo Sheep case now.
There's a background person to the case of the bid that the court kind of goes into, and it starts out with, the great, American desert and how the West was sort of unsettled at first, and it was sending a lot of people to the West after their purchase, and however, the traffic was very hard. It was a 4 month long process to get all the way to the West, so the U.S. was trying to figure out how to create a railroad that would go to the West.
If I could pause you for a second there. First of all, let's put a little sauce on the facts. I'm curious, how many of you growing up played a game called Oregon Trail? It's like one of those cultural touchstones. How many of you actually killed your families over and over and over again? Pestilence, famine, disaster.
Oh, that's a good one. Is it? I didn't know it was possible for you to get diphtheria. Yeah. I hate to say, unless you walk on all fours, I don't think you can get diphtheria, but I'll take that. That's what the Transcontinental Railroad was designed to prevent, to keep that, to make it easy to connect the West Coast with the East Coast. Remember, this is during the time of the Civil War. There were some critical, immediate national priorities to get it done now, right away. So with the background music of Bonanza, Rawhide, Wild Wild West playing in the background, which I realize are all shows that were almost before my time, much less your time, we now have the proposal of, what was you said, a checkerboard land grant? What does that mean?
So it meant that for each mile of traffic, specifically down, the surrounding land is divided into a checkerboard where every section is private.
Okay.
And every public section was even.
So who held the private part?
The U.S., the federal government.
The private?
Sorry, the private?
Yeah.
Oh, Union Pacific.
Okay. So here's the railroad drawn in horrible proportion. Essentially, then, what you're talking about is that flaring out from each side were parcels of property. This one goes to Union Pacific. The others go to the United States.
And, guys, I know this sounds like history, musty. This is currently a major division and allocation of millions of acres of property still today. So with that, keep going. So why? We now have this strange checkerboard arrangement. Why? Why would the government do something as silly as sort of parcel it up?
At the time, it was the best way to get the whole railroad done. And in order to make it go all the way to the West, so it was the best way to, incentivize the Pacific.
But incentivize? So what do you mean?
That it was very expensive, and the U.S. would be able to match
so why not just give Union Pacific 1 million acres of property and say, go build a railroad? Why bother with this checkerboard?
At the time, there was also a national state of making sure the U.S. owned part of the railroad just in case Union Pacific went under, or the
absolutely true. It's a little before the trust buster times, but I will simply say, again, why not give it to Union Pacific up front? Why bother with this checkerboard arrangement? Here's a million acres of land. It's worth $1 billion. Go build. What's this weird arrangement with the checkerboard serving?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, if you don't mind, I can throw it up with everyone here. I didn't mean to just pick on you today. I know it's the first day from spring, right? I know there are some history majors in here as well. Anyone know why you do this sort of... Yes?
Because it's because the railroad was so important to the national interest that they wanted to have it at least in part nationalized, not completely in the hands of the private market.
Except there's a small problem. The railroad still is in the hands of the private company. Just the property surrounding it was divided up. So they didn't have control of the railroad because of the part of this checkerboard approach. But I like the idea. There's a sort of vested stake that they share.
It seems like a compromise in order to get Union Pacific to build the railroad. Like that was the compromise, the term of the compromise.
Give it up front. $1 billion is a lot of incentive. Jake?
To encourage settlement along the railroad.
How so? I mean, that's one of the reasons to build the railroad. Why did this strange arrangement to get Union Pacific to do?
Well, because the private interest holds it, they cannot make the land so expensive that nobody can afford to buy it.
Interesting. Although the Homestead Act, basically, you got it for free if you just put down the state.
This is for history. That's what I'm trying to do.
All right. Any last suggestions?
They can also sell off those other pieces later down the road.
Yes. I tease you about the Canadian answer, but I'm not going to do that right now. Let me give you a giant hint. Speed. This was a project that had languished for years and years. The Civil War was brewing. This railroad had to be built yesterday. So the key fact, and David, you've identified this beautifully, but the case doesn't really pick that up. This checkerboard arrangement doesn't kick in until the railroad is built, and it's built mile by mile. So essentially, the faster Union Pacific laid that track, the more property they got. Remember, at the other end of the line, you have the other end of the line being built by a different company. Meet up in the middle of the United States and drive that golden spike. So speed was wealth. This statute is designed to prioritize and reward the ones who build day and night as fast as humanly possible. So it does create an odd situation then. Essentially, your neighbor for every mile, every other mile, for thousands of miles, is the federal government. Now, I've interrupted you. I've put probably too much sauce in the facts at this point. What is the legal issue then as a result of this point?
So, as time went by, Union Pacific, I guess the land that was private, was somehow right down the line
side of it, but the reservoir the government built could only be accessed by crossing Leo's property. So the government said, what right do we have legally to build the road?
They said that they had the right to easement.
An implied easement.
Yeah, implied, yes.
Now I'll pause. Has Professor Kumar talked with you about easements and implied easements yet? Oh, come on. I see half of you going yes and the other half going no. This is a very bad sign for her. Spring break. Okay, so it is an implied easement. In other words, the statute, does it say it in black and white at all? Of course, that's the whole point of being implied. So, what was the analysis then of the court at this point? Now, of course, we're not talking about the court when this was happening. We're not talking about Justice Rehnquist, who, by the way, loved history. Yeah, he wrote, keep going, I'm sorry.
Reservation and the government didn't write the interim on the land.
By the way, you should, the reading panel for today should thank you because you've just now done a beautiful example of legislative history. Keep going.
And in further reservations, the act lists specific reservations that federal government would help, but it omitted the right to use it. And Rehnquist was reasoning that if they had presumed to have the right to use it, they would not have left it out.
So I know the midterm approaches, final approaches, what can, would that essentially implicate? If Congress fails to mention something, and you impute that failure to mention is the intent not to include it, what's that canon of construction?
Oh, wow, spring break really did have an effect, you guys. If I say one thing, and it excludes everything else, the Latin term is expressio unus. All right, I got to do this just to make sure everyone's awake. I even see a yawn on the back row. Together now, expressio unus.
Expressio unus. Thank you. Travis leads the chair, of course. Okay, so we now have legislative history. We have expressio unus. Anything else? Rehnquist used to support this?
Precept that there's an implied easement doesn't apply here, as you pointed out, because the government is not like your normal private landowner who needs an easement to get to their land. The government can take it any time it wants to. That's the beauty of being the sovereign. They just have to pay for it. Now, pausing for a minute, Rehnquist did this quite a bit. He loved to tuck in fairly sizable concepts into throwaway mentions. What he basically said was the government's power to declare an implied easement is fairly restricted, if not non-existent. That's a huge idea. Notice he just sort of, it's almost a throwaway. Hey, anything else said? So?
No, I think that's
okay. So, who won?
So, we go to the private owner of the land.
All right, so basically the end result of this is Leo gets a check.
Yes.
The road's already built. Who determines what the amount of the check is? No, that's an unfair question. It's not the case. But basically, the government determines the fair value of the land. So to a certain extent, and I wish I knew the answer to this, I've always wondered how much Leo actually got for all his pain and trouble here, because the government's not known for being overly generous in assessments of property that it takes by eminent domain. The key thing here from this case, besides the fact that it's a beautiful summary of all the things we've talked about so far, is, the textbook says it, you can almost hear the racket of the wheels in the background of the train rolling across the American West. It is an accepted common tool in statutory interpretation to refer to the historical context of the statute independent of the legislative process. And think back to our Holy Church case, Holy Trinity Church, with all the discussion about the newspapers reporting the problems that were facing society from immigrants flooding the market. History is a valid tool for using. But notice, Justice Rehnquist doesn't go to the evidence of the case in the trial transcript. He doesn't go to any lower court determinations what the history was. He just basically either goes from generally acknowledged and known historical facts, or alternatively, he cites the historical reference sources. That's about it. I mean, I will tell you again, and I know I keep doing this to you, I apologize, but I will say that in cases I've worked on, they tend to be in the environmental context. I can tell you we've hired historians. Hired historians to offer testimony in disputed cases
as to what exactly was happening in some of the places where we'd argue about back in Revolutionary War times, to provide the historical context as to what the responsible allocation of liability for the parties were under the statutory terms. So this is, you know, it's kind of tucked away one. This is one that I guarantee you'll be coming back to again and again. So with that, David, I'll give you the last word. Anything else you want to add in this case?
No,
glad it's in your rearview mirror and you'll never have to look at it again.
Yeah.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so that is common law. That is history. Now we get to the big one, the big kahuna, the gorilla, the one that we've been talking about collaterally already for most of this semester. Specifically, legislative history. What role does legislative history play, specifically in the appropriate interpretation of statutes? It's obviously one of the most controversial battlegrounds of statutory interpretation, with starkly drawn lines of positions drawn by different jurists. With that, remind yourselves, we've already talked about how legislative history is generated. The first part of our class, the legislative process. And we talked about how there is sort of a list, a hierarchy of the most reliable sources that courts will go to first. Almost always, the first touchstone, the place courts will look to first, will be either the conference committee report, because that's the final committee that lays its hands typically on the statute and writes the final provisions, or the committees that have original primary jurisdiction over the bill that had to mark up and draft the provisions in question. I can tell you, if you don't have reports and you're starting to wander to other sources of legislative history, it starts getting a lot harder. Usually next, the persons who draft the legislation, individual sponsors, and then floor statements, colloquies, different public utterances in the legislative process that provide the background for how provisions were written and incorporated to the statute. So I'll pause here. Hopefully this is all a breath of familiarity to you. You guys are going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell me something new today. It's after spring break, I need something to get my blood going. Okay? Here's the first question to sort of get the synapses firing. Why do some jurists, including Justice Scalia, hate using conference reports so badly? You were ready for that one. Your hand went up. I think that's the shortest delay I've seen in an answer yet this semester. Question?
He cites two different issues. One of the things he says is like it's not really the will of Congress, it's the will of the individual people. I think, and the other thing he kind of harps on a lot is the fact that it's sort of written after the fact, like the committee reports are often written sort of after the fact, after much of the paper had taken place. So there's like a lot of room for staffers. Like he's, I think one of the cases he talks about, the any position of the staffers and to be able to sort of draft the legislative history and sort of make that.
Okay. And I assume you're quoting now that his concurrence in our next case we're going to talk about. Okay. So that was two. The fact that constitutionally, text of the statute is the only thing that matters. So why are we looking anywhere else? Number two, basically, why we put ourselves in the hands of lobbyists? These materials are imminently subject to manipulation. And since they're quarters on, I won't tell you about things I've seen happen in this regard, although I do believe we have folks in here who have been familiar with the legislative process and know what I'm talking about. Yes?
So
why should they be? You're wearing a tie.
So I mean, why do they mean? They just gotta have less relevance. Yes.
Okay. Is there a particular reason that why we should basically care that this has gone through the full legislative process as opposed to materials that are not the final text signed by the president? Which part?
The
legislative process. Sorry, I'm teasing you. Now I'm giving you a little bit of a hard time. Article 1, Section 7,
yep.
The presentment clause. The idea that you actually have to have an actual process of presentation, bicameral consideration, and signature or override by either the executive or by the House of Congress. So essentially, why have this process, according to, I don't mean to pick on Scalia, others agree with him. Why go through this process if at the end of the day we're going to ignore the language of the statute and look to what this conference committee report said? Okay?
So that's, and I think that sort of repeats your first point to a certain extent, doesn't it, Jeff? All right, anything else besides those two? And you don't have to say what Scalia said. I yes, please.
Can't be amended, right?
Why not?
Because, you know, it's not the same legislative process for a report like that. You know, after they're done, a lot of them approve it. They don't even look at the committee report once the law's enacted. You can't go back and change the committee report. You don't amend the law.
Why not? I don't mean to pick on you as well. I'm picking on everybody today. This is what happens when I have jet lag. I'm sorry. I'll tell you, why not have a conference committee report that comes out, it says something that someone else who is in the minority finds outrageous. Why not have a minority codicil attached to that report? Minority legislators' views. No, that's an open-ended question. There's no right or wrong answer to it. It does happen. You will find that those sometimes some reports happen, but I'll also say it's pretty rare.
I mean, I guess it's kind of like the lobbyist thing, you know, they can sneak it in there because, you know, what if it's a hostile committee, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. By the way, is anyone here interested in becoming a lobbyist or legislative practitioner? One hand goes up, two, three. You're all clustered together.
We are over there.
Oh, thank you. Of course. All right. I will refrain from using words like sneaky or underhanded. Okay, but we've worried about manipulation, we've worried about constitutional issues. Anything else, Maddie?
And then our text mentioned that some people say that markups are much more informative than committee reports are, because you can see, I do think you can see a lot. As much as I think committee reports are helpful to an extent, I think there is a point when you see what changes were made before you got the final consensus version.
Okay. So is your point, Amanda, that the conference committee reports are not as valuable as a markup, therefore we shouldn't give them much?
I don't necessarily think that. I just know that it's a point in some people argue it.
Okay.
I think that they could both be valuable.
Okay.
But I would look more to a committee report than a markup. I just know it's a point that some people say that markups are more, might give us a little more insight than committee report
would. That's a good point. I probably regret saying this. I often have thought one thing they should make new professors do when they start teaching is to sit through first year courses and just get a sense of what you guys are experiencing soup to nuts. Because I find myself constantly asking, are you doing this in your other classes? So I am curious, in your legal writing courses or others, have you had to actually read a conference report yet? All right. Now, I know we have folks who have actually worked in law libraries, worked in the legislative process, so I assume some of you guys outside of law school have had a chance to read it. So I'll just ask, would anyone like to volunteer their impression of having to read a conference committee report or substantive committee report? Yes, I was thinking of you since I know you've done this. She's diplomatic, saying they're written in English.
Yes.
They're designed to be comprehensible to the busy legislator who doesn't want to have to parse this damn statutory text. I'm sorry. Darn statutory text. So, in a way, that's good. I think it's fair to say a lot of legislators vote on bills never having read the bill. They read the report. So to a certain extent, that might give you a better sense of what the intent might be. However, since they are written in English, since they are not designed with that picky particular precision of statutory language, which makes it so hard to read, it means conference committee reports and substantive committee reports are oftentimes just as ambiguous as the statute. They also often fail to address particular issues. I'll tell you the one I spent 18 months in an arbitration fighting over was a conference report that discussed language in the statute that clearly expressed the intent, but then the language that was being discussed was deleted from the statute and replaced with other language. But there's nothing in the report about the later language. Does that report still give you any kind of useful indicia on what the statutory legislative purpose is or intent? So, point being here, I want you to not get wrapped up in
than what Scalia says, or what Sotomayor thinks, or what Breyer's position is. I was just want you to step back and think for yourselves for a little bit. What is it about conference committee reports that make them useful, but because of those very strengths, what also limits their potential use? So with that in mind, we now have sort of identified some strengths and weaknesses. Let's turn to our cases for today. And the first case is Blanchard v. Bergeron. And here's one of those ones where I suspect you guys sitting on a beach, the waves lapping your toes, reading this case, or skiing down the slopes of Brackenridge, thinking about this case. A lot of his reaction was, oh my God, attorney's fees cases, this is so boring. All right, I will simply say, I can see that might be an initial reaction when you're being distracted by other things involving alcohol. But I will tell you, it's enormously important. I've seen entire fields of practice wither because the interpretation given to a statute by the courts deprived the ability of plaintiffs to get attorneys to represent them because the attorneys wouldn't get paid. So with that in mind, Amanda, I think you're up for bat first today. Give us a little sense as to what this case is about.
So the facts of this case, there was a jury that awarded Blanchard $10,000 in damages on his claim that a sheriff deputy deprived him of his civil rights under 42 United States Code 1983 because he had been beaten by a sheriff deputy. The district court awarded him $7,500 in attorney's fees under a statute that I'll read in a minute, and the appellate court reduced the attorney's fees to $4,000, saying that the 40% was an appropriate amount for the attorney to get because the plaintiff and the lawyer had a fee arrangement, and that fee arrangement therefore limited the amount of fees he was able to be awarded. The statute that we're going to be interpreting, or that this court interpreted, was the Civil Rights Attorney Fee Award Act, Section 1988. And it says, a court in its discretion may allow a reasonable attorney's fee to a prevailing party in federal civil rights actions under USC 1983. So we're really trying to figure out what is a reasonable attorney's fee? Is it limited to the amount provided by the contingent fee arrangement, or is it something else? The majority focused a lot on both the Senate committee report and also the House committee report, not quite as much as the Senate committee report, though. And let's see. The court's holding ended up being that the initial estimate of a reasonable attorney's fee is calculated by multiplying the number of hours reasonably expended on the litigation times a reasonable hourly rate, and then they applied 12 factors from the Johnson case. They got to this holding because both the Senate committee report and the House committee report referred to 12 factors from this Johnson case that discuss how you should assess a reasonable attorney fee. And one of those factors, one of the factors of the 12, said that the attorney and client's was the attorney and client's payment agreement. The Johnson case, when you actually looked at it more, and this part that I'm about to say was not in either the House or Senate committee reports, but the Johnson case said that the criterion is not what the parties agree, but what is reasonable, and it additionally put a limit on the amount of attorney's fees not to be above what the attorney and his client agreed upon.
So if I could pause you for a second there. Johnson, which was a circuit court opinion, mm-hmm. said no, to a certain extent. It can't be, if they agree to X, the court can't say you get 3X.
Yeah, they don't give you more. They say the Johnson case put a cap on what the attorneys could get by what the attorney and his client had agreed upon. So if they said 40% of damages, the Johnson case says that you can't award more than 40%.
Okay. So, was that the end of it then? It sounds like then at this point.
So the Senate committee report and the House committee report refer to the 12 factors in Johnson, but they don't actually say what we just discussed. they don't talk about that cap. The Senate report discusses three cases that they say correctly apply the Johnson factors, and none of those cases put a cap on the attorney fee agreement. Mm-hmm. The first case, Stanford Davy versus Zurchers, the holding was that the contingent fee was a factor but not dispositive in the fee award. The second case that the Senate committee report refers to says that the court gave a fee award to an attorney in a public interest firm, which otherwise wouldn't have even been entitled to a fee. And the third case that the Senate committee report refers to says that reasonable fees should be granted regardless of the individual plaintiff's fee obligation.
All right, so again, rising up a little bit from the weeds then. One circuit court case, which says essentially, if they've agreed, you can't award more. The other are three cases that refer to in a different report, which are district court cases.
I'm not, let me see. It doesn't say what level the cases were actually.
Well, it doesn't say directly in the text, and it comes up later in the dissent.
District court.
So essentially, you've got a battle of the circuit courts, what could be viewed as a holding, versus district courts, which said something different. Mm-hmm. And now you have this totally bizarre situation where the U.S. Supreme Court is trying to figure out which holding to follow of its lower courts. Mm-hmm. Why? Why bother? They're Supreme Court. Why don't they just sort of say, Shazam, we're done. We don't have to follow the circuit court. We don't have to pay attention to district court. We can interpret de novo. We have appellate authority.
Well, they were putting a lot of focus on the committee reports. I think that's the big point of this case, or the majority was. A little different than the concurrence. But
no.
The majority did put a lot of focus on the committee reports, and they said that since the Senate committee report explicitly referred to these three cases, that kind of trumped that dicta in the Johnson case that said the attorney fees were capped based on the attorney-client fee arrangement. So, although it's interesting because the three cases that I discussed were only in the committee or the Senate committee report, the House report doesn't refer to those cases. It only refers to the 12 factors. So this court, the majority, did put more weight on the Senate report than anything else. They also had some policy reasons that they had it, but and I didn't list this, but it really was focused on the committee reports.
All right, so again, stepping up a little bit, what we have then essentially is, first of all, let's start with the most important point from our perspective. Again, you can disagree with me if you like, you're propounding the case today. Legislative history is clearly at the heart of the interpretive process being used by the majority here. So to do that, they go look to the reports. The reports are like this. One refers to a circuit court case which seems to hold one way. The other is referring to three district court cases that seem to go the other way. So you end up with this very careful parsing of which cases did Congress have in mind when it wrote the report underlying this statute, which could be used to interpret this text. So am I capturing what you're saying fairly there?
You are. And I think some of that, I can go to the concurrence too, but in a minute, but I think what you're saying brings up a valid point from the concurrence. Like, the Johnson case was referred to, but it wasn't like it was listed the whole way through. And Scalia, in his concurrence, makes the point that it was very unlikely that people who were voting on this sat and like went and looked at the Johnson case and looked at all of that, or even looked at the three cases that were mentioned in the Senate committee report. So I thought there was quite a bit of parsing in how this should be played. As much as I do personally think that committee reports have relevance to find the original meaning, not necessarily the original intent, but the original meaning of what the this statute was the way that this, the majority analyzes this, they focus so much on these cases that I feel like they almost dove in too much to the committee reports.
So you think Scalia was right? There was no member of Congress who possibly read these reports down to this level of detail. Parsed, what was the dicta, what was the holding?
I agree, I'm not as strong as...
Or pungent. His writings, I'm sorry, keep going.
I don't agree with, especially now, his statements, which seem maybe a little stronger even than this, but I do think that he had a point that when the committee report just mentions a case that people aren't going to go back and like sit and like read that case and really think about it. I think that is a little unrealistic. I do, however, think that the committee report can give insight to what the original meaning was meant to be. It kind of gives some context to what people were thinking.
So I could flag a question for you then. If the committee report, however, says something at variance with the plain text of the statute, you're saying it gives context, but it can't override.
I
agree. I'm about to take off my tie here. That's roasting it here.
I don't think that something in the committee report should be able to trump or take over something that is in the text plain language. But I do think that it can give insight, when something's ambiguous, I do think it can give insight to the original meaning.
Okay, hold that thought then. I'm waiting for Donna to reach over and slap in the back of the head because this is her case coming up next. Okay, so time presses on. You captured the case and its details very well. I think sort of takeaways here. First, my favorite question, who won? So based how often you read the analysis, you have to stop and think.
The plaintiff won that who filed because he got more attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
It was his attorney's fees were not limited by his agreement with his attorney. They were what the court determined more could be a reasonable attorney fee.
Right, so he won, but more importantly, his lawyer won.
Yes.
Yeah, he got paid, or she got paid more. Hopefully Professor Turner will talk with you more about 1983 and civil rights litigation, but the ability to get your attorney's fees is critical. The idea that you can get reasonable fees even if you've agreed to something less or even if you've agreed to something more is actually a reaffirmation of the court's ability and powers under Section 1988 to just look at that agreement as a reference point but not be bound by the allocation of fees to the attorneys. But for this case, it's particularly notable for two things. One, this is about as down the weeds as you can possibly get on going through and harmonizing legislative reports, committee reports. Especially since, as we talked about earlier, what's the problem with committee reports? Sometimes they don't match up. Sometimes you have to try and figure out how the pieces fit to get the best way. You did point out, and I want to make sure we flag it, it wasn't just the reports. They also looked to the purpose of the statute as elucidated by those reports. And the overall purpose was to promote civil rights litigation, to give reasonable attorneys fees so that the attorneys be willing to take the cases, but not make them so much about the money, show me the money, that you could also have attorneys who do it for injunctive relief, where the cases where they'll never get a dime, but they can try and preserve and protect the civil right. It's also noteworthy because this is one of Scalia's more pungent concurrences about the value of looking to the legislative history in this context. In his mind, basically, Congress enacts statutes. This other stuff is just a distraction. Now, I will flag a question. Perhaps we can talk about it in greater detail in our next class. But I want you to perhaps think about one issue. It comes up in this case. It's going to come up. Stana's going to explain in our next case about what's the constitutional underpinning of Scalia's position and also Judge Easterbrook's opinion, which basically says only the Constitution's only language that matters under the Constitution is the statute itself because it's the only thing that's presented. Now, the book points to other constitutional provisions, the rules provision, for example, the rules clause, the journal clause as well, and Article 1, Section 5, as examples of how Congress was constitutionally given the power under the Constitution to set its own procedures, to create its own committees, to create this body of information that the Constitution encompasses and validates and makes relevant to the context of a statute. Let me offer you one other question before we get to our last two cases. So what? Is there another possible rationale, which is, why are we worried about the Article III power of the judges? The constitutional argument seems to focus on what matters on the legislative side in terms of getting a bill turned into a law. But what we're talking about here is judicial review as well, the power of the courts to determine the meaning of a statute. To a certain extent, that's a separate embodiment of power, that the courts have their own plenary authority to determine. In other words, if an Article III court says, because of my powers of judicial review to decide a case of controversy, I need to look at the conference reports. I need to look at the newspapers for that day. Why isn't that also valid under Article III, rather than worrying about what Article I says? Obviously, that's not a question that has a confirmed black or white answer that I offer for you to think about as we get to our next two cases, which is In re Sinclair. And this is one that Don, can you help us on this? What's going on in this case?
A year after they filed, Congress added Chapter 12, which would provide more benefits to farmers. They asked anyone to transfer their bankruptcy action over to the Chapter 12 action, but the courts ruled that from the explicit language of 302C of the Family Farmer Bankruptcy Act that it wasn't allowed.
Okay.
Because the statute said the amendments made shall not apply to cases commenced under Title 11 of the Code for the effective date of the Act. So that didn't include them. The problem was the statute was at odds with the committee report that was inserted for 302C, which would allow the court to use their discretion as to the sequential request to transfer over to Chapter 12. So the court had to decide which would be followed, the statute or the committee report.
Mm-hmm.
And they also answered, is the statute the law or is it just evidence of the law? So. They looked at when to use the plain meaning approach and how legislative history can help them do that. So they said sometimes it's necessary to reconstruct the legal and the political culture of the drafters, and legislative history could aid in the reconstruction on how the authors assumed their words would be understood.
Okay. So Judge Easterbrook says legislative history is totally fine.
Yes.
You can use it whenever you need to, as long as you provide context for the plain text of the statute.
Yes, he said clarity depends on the context.
Okay.
The process is objective. So he said we're looking at the rules of language the authors use.
So.
Not necessarily there.
So jumping to the end of the matter, my favorite question, who wins?
The farmers did not win. They said it was clear and unambiguous, so they weren't willing to go with the committee report.
Okay, so let me make sure we're conveying the gravity of the situation. A family farm is about to be declared bankrupt under Chapter 11 under much harsher terms than Chapter 12, probably dispossessed, evicted, sent to live on the side of the road. Easterbrook's fine with that, even though Congress clearly said that that was not their intent in legislative history. So, just to convey again, the dimensions of Easterbrook's position here, even if Congress clearly said X, if the statute said not X, it doesn't matter. Even if every legislator who wrote the provision came into court and testified that we meant X, If the statute said not X, that's all that matters. Even if it works harsh effects on the people that was designed, the statute designed to protect according to its purpose as written in the statute, not X applies. I'm pushing you for a reason. I'll make sure we understand what Easterbrook's saying. It's a fairly strong position.
It is. He really felt legislative history can't be used to contradict the words of the statute.
So what about Scrivener's error?
He said it's only allowed to solve doubt and not create it. So he wasn't willing to take it any further than that.
But isn't this clearly an error? Scrivener's error is a doctrine accepted by other courts. Is Easterbrook basically saying Scrivener's error? If the text is clear, you have to disregard the possibility that legislators screwed up. If it's a typo, if it's a mistake, as long as it's clear, you're bound by the language. Okay? All right. I'm curious. I'll pause here. Is anyone in this room kind of a little bit uncomfortable with this end result? Or is everyone comfortable with the idea that Easterbrook's position that it doesn't matter what Congress actually intended? It doesn't matter what legislature's thought when they're drafting for the language. If the language is clear, you're bound by the results of the statute. You're just drinking, you're not saying, but you get popping your pop, right? Okay. Sir Don.
When you read in the case and it says that there was, you know, some pretty funny business going on as far as that clause, and it probably was understood to have been removed, and it actually contradicts other areas of Chapter 11.
There is some subtext here, definitely. Let's just simply say Eskridge has a point of view. Namely, that Easterbrook screwed up. He got it wrong. That the legislative history he's pointing to actually is dealing with a different provision of the statute. It's interesting, when the leading authority in statute interpretation of the nation alerted the judge of this, Easterbrook's response was, so what? I still would not change my opinion in this circumstance because the language is still clear in the statute. That's how strong this is. For that point, this case is not one that's meant to challenge you with the complexity of this doctrinal analysis. It's much as just an illustration of the way that legislative history used to be constrained if you have with this new textualist position. It's probably one of the most leading examples of the stringent approach you could be using in this context. With that, I will simply say, you know, I asked you the Scrivener's Doctrine question because it's interesting, the case doesn't even raise it. Remember, Scrivener's Doctrine is real. It is a tool for statutory interpretation. Remember, we mentioned it in the first part of the class. But remember, it is narrow. It tends to be reserved for situations where there's almost like a typo, where there's a numerical transposition, where there's a failure to do something that's relatively controversial. But the courts are very wary to use this doctrine to go against the overt, plainly expressed, comprehensible text of a statute. For example, Scrivener's error will help you if the statute says April 31st is the deadline. It will not help you if it says April 29th is the deadline, even though the legislature clearly meant April 30th, they just screwed up in writing it. That clear for everyone? So that leaves us then with our last case for today. And it's a doozy. We get to talk about sex offenders now. So with that in mind, Penny, I would save this case for you since I know you're interested in criminal law. So I was wondering if you could give us a sense of what's going on with Carr versus the United States.
Okay, so Carr was a guy who had been convicted of sex offense, and he relocated from Indiana to Alabama prior to SORNA going into effect.
All right. Pretend we're ignorant judges. What is SORNA?
Oh, SORNA is the Sex Offender Registration.
Sorry, SORNA.
And Notification Act of 2006.
Okay. Yeah, so what is SORNA? Describe a little
bit. Okay. It says it makes it a federal crime for any person who is required to register under SORNA and who travels in interstate or foreign commerce to only fail to register or update the registration.
Okay. So this covers any sex offender. Egregious serial child molesters all the way to the classic statutory rape case for self-defense.
the ATM party. So anybody, if they change who cross state lines, they have to register.
Right.
So what was the issue with Carter? Why are they here?
The issue was that he actually relocated prior to the effective date of SORNA. So he ended up being convicted anyway of a violation. And he claimed that it was a violation of his constitutional rights under the ex post facto. But the trial court rejected that. And then he was basically stating that it required both interstate travel and relocation after SORNA for it to be valid for conviction. But the government said that only failure to register was sufficient for conviction.
So if I could, just make sure it's clear, Carter would say, yeah, I've got to register if I move across state lines at any point in the future.
Right.
But if I stay put, in which state was it, Illinois? Whatever state you moved to.
Yeah, he went from Indiana to Alabama.
Interesting direction to go. I don't mean that as any kind of comment, just to think. Anyway, I'm going to be in all sorts of trouble if I go that way. Basically, he stays there, and he's invisible. He's off the radar. He doesn't have to register with Alabama. He doesn't have to register with Indiana.
Right.
He weaves under the net of the statute.
Yeah.
The government's position is, at the chime of midnight, the effective date of the act, every sex offender in the nation had to pick up their phone and call the state that they're in, the federal government, as well as the state they came from, and say, hey, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So with that in mind, what did the court say?
The court said that it applied to both elements. So not only moving and failure to register once it was affected. So basically, he won.
Okay. So Justice Sotomayor, bless you. I forget, it's allergy season now. What was Justice Sotomayor's rationale then?
She used a medley of things. Yeah. She first started with the statutory language and said that by its terms, the first element of the order is satisfied and the person is required to register under SORNA. So she emphasized the word under by saying that obviously it applies once the SORNA becomes effective, not prior to.
So verb tense.
Yes.
The fate of every sex offender in the nation depends on the tense of the verb used by Congress. That reflected an intent by the statute, the legislative person. Okay, just making sure we understand, you know, the gravity, the consequences of the fairly low-level change in the statute. Okay, keep going.
Okay, and then as far as what you were saying, present tense, she looked at the word travels and went into an analysis there about the fact that it was, you know, present tense and not past tense. So she said that the fact that they used present tense reinforced the conclusion that prior travel fell outside of the scope.
Okay. But I may not move to the rest of the class because I've discovered the sweet spot with the air conditioning is pouring down right here. Okay. So Justice Sotomayor basically starts with just the text of the statute. It says that the choice of verb tense reflects a conscious choice by Congress as to the effective operation of the statute. Did Congress actually say anything like that in black and white in the statute beyond the verb tense?
She actually, I think she cited some past case and stated that Congress could have chosen past tense, but they decided not to. So she basically took that as an implication that had they wanted to refer to past tense, they would have included that. So the fact that they did is because that's not what their intent was.
Fair enough. Certainly, that's part of the whole code of construction canon. If you look at other provisions in the same code, or even the whole act, with the same act, if Congress has shown that it can distinguish in verb tenses to make that choice, its election to use a different approach must be in some way conscious. So in a way, it's a linguistic canon approach. Is there anything beyond just the linguistic approach here?
Yeah, she went into, she cited the Dictionary Act.
Yes, and it's the first case I think we've seen the Dictionary Act actually used.
So again, she said that the government was not able to identify any time when the court had construed
All right. So any discussion of legislative history materials then that we can point to as part of our discussion for today?
Yeah. She went into the House Judiciary Committee report.
Okay.
And spoke about what the purpose of SORNA was. So I guess the government was saying that the goal was to track missing sex offenders because once they were moved, they would go missing. So they were trying to invoke that argument.
Is that right?
I'm sorry.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, it makes sense.
Okay. But she had disagreed. If the goal was to register sex offenders, why should give it this essentially one-time pass to every sex offender who stays put?
Well, she said that she said that the government was incorrect because they were using the general goal of SORNA with specific purpose of Section 22. And then she went on and explained that Section 22 is a standalone that is part of like a broader, I guess like the whole code rule type thing, where all of those rules together were supposed to address that issue. So it wasn't necessarily just up to 2215 to address the issue of missing sex offenders.
It's an interesting rhetorical step. Basically, there's a difference between the goal of the statute writ large and the specific intention of a statutory provision in isolation. And essentially, this verb tense selection for effective date implementation essentially had a different purpose than the overall goal of the statute, which is interesting because is there any legislative history to support the fact that there's a difference between the two that she cites?
I think she cites the House report, doesn't she?
For the general goal of the statute. Does she actually talk about the fact that how it's spelled prospectively or not?
Yeah, I think she says that nothing in the legislative record suggests that Congress intended to alter the statute's intent.
But, okay, now I'm starting to argue with Sotomayor through you, so my apologies. Essentially, the language of the statute is parsed in that way because the verb tense, the legislative history, doesn't reflect any reason why Congress would choose to do something differently. But notice there's a small sidestep there. There's also nothing in the legislative history saying the other direction either. Essentially saying it doesn't challenge her grammatical interpretation. Set Scalia's concurrence aside for now, what does the dissent say? What does Alito do? By the way, it's fun to see Alito and Scalia go in different directions. What does Alito say?
Well, he kind of goes with a logical and textual analysis and says that that it basically relieving him of duty to register would constitute an observed result.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, an observed result.
Okay.
Yeah, to allow him to not register.
Why is it absurd?
Well, because the purpose was to keep track of them. So if the ones that move before it goes enacted, effective, and they don't have to register, it doesn't really address the issue of where they are or to keep track of them.
And does he directly take on Sotomayor's point about the verb tense or the other general goal of the statute versus specific intent of this provision?
Yeah, he says that it flies in the face of widely accepted modern legislative drafting conventions. And he references the Senate and House legislative drafting manuals and says that those specifically teach legislators to draft in the present tense.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I may have to jump a little bit because our time's about up. When you've captured it, here's the thought. I'll tell you, everybody when this opinion came out went, what? Where did that come from? That was the first time legislative drafting manuals popped up as a tool of statutory interpretation. I put the legislative drafting manuals for the state legislature on the website so you get a sense as to what kinds of materials they provide, what kind of guidance they give. They are not designed to guide interpretation. Matter of fact, there's been some good, hard, field-level work with interviewing legislators and staffers. But they say basically up front, you know, some of these canons we've been discussing in class really don't play a role at all in how they draft. So we've talked about this in some of our earlier classes. So heads up, at least as far as Alito is concerned and the other two justices, there's some indication that drafting manuals may be a background factor for consideration if you're doing linguistic analysis. And now, to wrap up, as always, it's fun to finish with Scalia. What's Scalia's point here?
Oh, he just went on his usual saying that he felt that only what Congress had voted on mattered, and this arrest was just under state as a common state of government and the enactment process, and he felt that 2250 was pretty much the same.
But he didn't dissent, he concurred, right?
Yeah, he did.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to make sure I'm not doing disjustice here. Scalia is a brilliant jurist. He's had enormous influence. I don't mean in any way to dismiss his positions. I think you'll find most law professors respect the power of his pen and his mind. His positions in this area in particular have had a large influence. But Penny, you're absolutely correct. In one sense, he concurs by saying, essentially, why are we doing this? We're wasting time. We just use the statutory language. And legislative history here is just basically me too. It's piling on. It's superfluous. I will invite you to consider that, because you've read enough cases now to be forming your own independent judgment. But I think you might find that, by and large, legislative history comes up usually at the tail end. They've already reached a decision. Then they start mining the legislative history to find support for the position that they presented. So, to a certain extent, is there a risk in introducing legislative history analysis that doesn't do anything other than just buttress conclusions available by other means? Final point as well, I say this in all my classes, I've said it in this one before, I'm just embarrassed to do it occasionally. When you get out in the real world, remember, you commit malpractice if you forget about the state. State laws differ, state procedures differ. The rules that govern your case most likely are state, not federal. The materials we're talking about right now for legislative interpretation are different on the state law. A lot of states don't have committee reports prepared for what we discussed. A lot of states don't have bill analyses that are presented to the legislative process as much as they are for the executive branch. So, particularly in Texas, but also whatever state you're in, don't get wrapped up in the federal case law and the Supreme Court's take on it. The state law is where you may have put the primary attention first. So with that, take a deep breath. You survived your first class after spring break. Any questions or thoughts before we move along? Okay. Remember, we will vote on the statute on Wednesday, and we're going to try and move along the legislative history discussion of going beyond comp reports and start talking about what you're doing with individual legislators. So with that, enjoy the beautiful weather today, and I'm going to go and take a nap.